I think I ought to make another preliminary comment about the subject tonight. I will refer to the Calvinists. And the minute I mention the name Calvinist, people begin to think of Presbyterians, but I'm not talking about Presbyterians at all. Wesley did not believe that he had any business with the Presbyterian Church. By and large, it was well-pastored, well-instructed, and well-disciplined. Wesley believed that his mission was to the Anglican Church, the Church of England, the Church of Ireland, which wasn't as well-disciplined, and to the unchurched. But if you have thought about it, whether you are an Anglican, a Congregationalist, a Baptist, or any other denomination, if you are an Evangelical, there is a strong note of Calvinism there. The Wesleyan Methodists were the exception to that. They were the evangelicals who were not Calvinistic, and you'll see what I'm talking about as I get through the subject. And I'm not going to talk about the four alls. John Wesley died in 1791. The four alls were put together in 1903, so he couldn't have known much about them. They were originated by the Reverend William Fitzgerald, who was one of the founders of the Wesley Guild, and were designed as a simple form of teaching young people the faith. They were slogans. They were catchphrases that would stay in the mind. Be careful. Catchphrases and slogans are very simple. Human beings are not. Every one of us, spiritually, mentally, and physically, are extremely complicated organisms, and that cannot really be simplified. I'm going to try and make as simple as possible what is the faith of a Methodist, distinctively, known sometimes as the Methodist Quadrilateral, but which we were taught as the Methodist Emphases. And my mind is going back to the church parlor in Rathgar and to four young men in their late teens or early 20s being taught by Wesley Littlewood to be Methodist preachers. Two of us became Methodist ministers. One of us left the church for the Church of Ireland, in which he is still flourishing, though not as a minister, and the other one became a Presbyterian because he married one and she wasn't prepared to tolerate his Methodism. And in that class, we learned the emphases of Methodism from a textbook, the name of which I cannot remember, but I think it was by a man called Williams. And the first of the emphases of Methodism was the universality of the atonement. Are you frightened at polysyllabic words? Universality simply means available everywhere to everybody, the world over. And the atonement is the atoning work of Christ in dying on the cross and rising on the third day. And Methodism has taught all through that that is available for every human being. The offer of forgiveness, the offer of redemption, the offer of God's grace is available to every human being. Not everyone is prepared to accept it. And the importance of that doctrine in Wesley's time was that it countered the extreme Calvinist doctrine of double predestination. The extreme Calvinists believed that God chose the elect for heaven, and he chose the other lot for hell. Now, that's what I mean by double predestination. If in that theory you were chosen for heaven, that was fine. You would get there. You had nothing to worry about. But if you were chosen for the other place, there was nothing you could do about it. And it is a rather horrid doctrine. I don't know of any modern Calvinist who would hold it. But it was held in those days, and that is one of the things that Wesley was arguing against. In order to have any goodness, you have got to have the possibility of evil. There has to be some element of choice somewhere in the scheme of salvation. But it's not something where you take the initiative. The initiative always comes from God. It is God's offer of salvation. I love baptizing babies. And I'll tell you why. Because I believe that the love, the atoning grace of Christ applies to that baby. The baby doesn't know it. The baby can't understand it. But that doesn't matter. That love is there available for him. And that is what I am saying as I baptize him. And the baptism of that child will be completed years after, when at confirmation or reception, whichever name you use for it, the child says, "Yes, I want this. I want to be his." So there is an act of faith in baptism. And I think that is the order of salvation. God in Christ redeemed us before we knew anything about it. But by the grace of God, in later years, you and I have come to say yes to him. And that is what is the first fundamental of Methodism. That is what led us out to talk to anyone where anyone would listen. This is the Methodist preachers at marketplaces, on street corners, in fields and barns, on crossroads, proclaiming to anybody who heard the love of God is for you. All you've got to do is accept it. And I've got to make two qualifications to that in a way. If salvation depends on your responding to the love of God, what about those who have never heard the gospel? The people who lived before Christ. The people who lived in places to which Christian missionaries didn't go at any given time. I believe that the covenant, that the uncovenanted mercies of God, as we sometimes call them, are able to deal with those people, that God will not hold it against them for failing to take an opportunity that in fact they never had. The love of God, the mercy of God, is immense. And the second thing is, what about people like a man I knew years ago? When his youngest child was born, mother asked me to baptize the child, and we had the greatest difficulty in persuading Dad to come to the baptism. He didn't want to have anything to do with the Christian church. They were all a pack of hypocrites. And I talked with his wife about his attitude, and it arose from the way he had been treated in a previous, allegedly Christian congregation whose treatment of him was certainly quite unchristian. Now, as far as I know, that man went through the rest of his life with the same attitude. But if God is just, and I believe he is, he is not going to blame that man for what was the action of a group of people who ought to have known better. It has been said that to know all is to understand all. And I think sometimes we judge people far too hastily without knowing the background and without knowing the reasons why they are what they are and the experiences that have warped them, as well as the experiences that have straightened them out. Now, what is peculiar about the four alls, if I may move on a bit, is that that particular emphasis, the universality of the atonement, was split by Fitzgerald into two. He said, all men need to be saved, all men may be saved. But that's just making two points out of what is really one point. The grace of God is available to everybody. And the reason why he split that in two was, I believe, because he was going to miss one of the most important emphases that would come at the end. So let's move on from the first point to the second. The witness of the Spirit. In the letter to the Romans, you have the comment that when we say Jesus is Lord, the Spirit is bearing witness with our spirits that we are his children. You cannot acknowledge Jesus as Lord without the grace of God. Because when the Romans, or when the early Christians talked about Lord, they were using a word that down through Jewish history had been used in the Old Testament. Have you noticed how often in old copies of the Old Testament the word Lord is spelt with four capital letters? In the original Hebrew text, there were the original four consonants, Yod, He, Wau, He, of the divine name. Vowels in Hebrew are dots above and below the line. So whenever they came across that Yod, He, Wau, He, they wouldn't say the name of God because that was so holy that to say it would pollute the house. It was a name that was never used except by the high priest on certain occasions after rites of purification. So the word they substituted was Adonai, Lord. And in the King James Version and other early versions of the English, that L-O-R-D in capital letters is the indication that that was where the divine name was. So when you said that Jesus was Lord, you were not just saying that he was a king, you were not just saying that he was a ruler, you were saying that he was God. He was the Son of God, that he was divine. And in order to do that, Paul argues, you need the grace of the Spirit of God to inspire and instruct you. And if you are really saying in word and deed that Jesus is Lord, if you are really treating him as divine, then that is one of the ways you may know that you are his child. There are other ways, less direct. Notice I'm not talking about feelings. If you look at a human life and you see that that life is filled with Christian virtues, with love, compassion, with faith, then you may know that that person is a Christian. And if people talk to you about how loving and how faithful and how gracious and compassionate you are, then you can say, well, that's the Spirit indirectly witnessing to me that I am one of his children. So the witness of the Spirit has two aspects, direct and indirect. And they are independent of our feelings. The fact that I feel good today doesn't mean a lot, because I might be down in the dumps tomorrow. Feelings are not to be trusted. It's evidence that is. And that, of course, is the third all. All men may know themselves saved. You notice I'm using the word men, because the formula was invented in 1903 when men in writing, as in real life, embraced women. We move on to number three. The phrase that we used in our classes was Christian perfection. A rather troublesome word. How many of us would claim to be perfect? And I remember the arguments that perfection was impossible, because everybody, however good they were, had some weakness somewhere. We weren't all perfect. So let me go back to a letter that John Wesley wrote to his banker, Robert Carr Brackenbury. I don't know what sort of letters you write to your bankers, but Robert Carr Brackenbury was a great supporter of John Wesley. And Wesley, near the end of his life, wrote to him and said, "The grand depositum that God has given to the Methodist people is to spread scriptural holiness throughout the land." That Wesley saw as our mission, our purpose, why we were called into being, to spread scriptural holiness throughout the land. So that is what is before us as the aim of our faith, our worship, our practice, to spread scriptural holiness. But we're a little bit confused, I think, by our scriptural holiness, because the church in the West, the church in Western Europe and subsequently in America, was tremendously influenced by the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire had a marvelous legal system. It lies at the base of our legal systems today. We may have overlaid it with an awful lot of other things, but fundamentally we start from where the Romans were. And the Romans said, if you are accused of a crime, if I am accused of a crime, then it's got to come to trial. And when we come into the courts, if our crime is sufficiently serious, we are judged not just by a judge, but by a judge and jury. A jury of 12 good citizens and true. And in Ireland and in England, there are only two possible verdicts. Either I am guilty or I am not guilty. There's nothing in between. In Scotland, there is a third possibility. The jury can say, not proven, by which they mean that the proof isn't enough to convince us that the criminal is guilty, but we still have a suspicion that he isn't entirely innocent, which I think is a fudge. But the Scots have been using it happily for years. It has probably taken quite a number of juries off the hook. But you see what we're talking about. Holiness is static in that understanding. You are either holy or you are not. And that is not the way John Wesley thought. And we have largely forgotten that that was not the way John Wesley thought. In the Holy Club at Oxford, John began to read three of the early Christian fathers who convinced him of the reality of holiness. They were Clement of Alexandria, they were Macarius the Egyptian, and Macarius was echoing Gregory of Nyssa. And those three didn't see holiness as a status, a state. It wasn't flat to them. It was dynamic. It was a progress. It was a process. And that puts holiness into a very different situation as we think about it. On one of his visits to Bath, John Wesley was challenged by Beau Nash, who was then the arbiter of fashion in Bath, and who accused Mr. Wesley of claiming to be holy. Wesley never did actually claim to be holy. Nash accused him of claiming to be holy, and Wesley's answer was, "I am not what I ought to be. But by the grace of God, I am not what I once was." Now you see what he was doing. He was putting himself somewhere on the spectrum between evil and holiness. He was recognizing that this thing was not a state to be in. It was a progress. It was a growth. It was a development. And that is what the Methodist classes and the Methodist bands were all about. You've heard of Methodist classes, haven't you? Have you ever heard of Methodist bands? See, we've forgotten about them. They dropped out of our thinking in the early 19th century. The classes lasted until the beginning of the 20th century. A class was a group of people, it may be as many as 30, under a class leader, who met regularly. And if they had any special experiences of divine grace since they last met, they could share them. But in the main, the meeting was conducted by a leader whose business was to exhort them to greater effort in holiness. I think it was that was in Donald English's mind at a conference in Bangor some years ago, when he said that the most notable thing about the early Methodists was not that they achieved holiness, but that they made a serious attempt at it. But I don't think that comment of Donald English was quite fair enough. I think, you see, there is this dynamic thought of spirituality in the minds of the early Methodists. They are moving towards something. And they were exhorted at their bands to be holy. At their class meetings, at their bands, there was something different. Bands were about seven people strong, never more. And what went on in bands was supposed to be entirely confidential. You didn't mix men and women. You had women's bands and you had men's bands. You didn't mix the married and the single. You had bands for married women and married men and single women and single men. They had to be fairly homogeneous. And you also divided them by age. The older with the older, the younger with the younger. And in those meetings, you met regularly to share your experiences of divine grace. Yes. To say, I had a marvelous experience last Tuesday, such and such a thing happened, and I really felt that God was with me. But also to share your failures. And that's the thing that some people have found horrid about the idea of Methodists. They thought it was done in class as well. And there is a sort of shudder about opening yourself up to people, exposing your inner thoughts and feelings. Oh, no, no, you want privacy, don't you? Not in your band meeting. And people thought perhaps it was pretty awful to tell the nasty things you did. But I think there's another aspect to it. If on Tuesday next I have to tell my band that on Saturday I got roaring drink and beat the daylights out of my wife, that's a very good incentive not to do it. Do you see what I mean? I think we have forgotten the preventive element in that sort of exchange of experience. You didn't do, unless you are seriously caught out, the things that you wouldn't want the other six to know. And the questions that Wesley put to the band were very searching questions indeed. Now, all of that was Wesley emphasizing the fact that holiness was not a static thing. It was not something you either were or were not. It was a journey you were making. It was a process that you were going through. It was a progress from nothing to something. Scriptural holiness. Forget about perfection. Now, in the Four Alls, that is the one that is usually written under all men may be saved to the uttermost. But if you take that gloss away, if you look at the simple sentence, all men may be saved to the uttermost, what in heaven's name does that word uttermost mean? I don't think it's a particularly helpful way of putting it. Maybe I'm biased. But you see, you've got four alls, but only three of the four Methodist emphases. What was the other one? The fourth emphasis, and it was tremendously important in the controversy with the Calvinists, was the necessity of continued faith for final salvation. The necessity of continued faith for final salvation. It was a counter to the Calvinist once saved, always saved. The contemporary Calvinist view was that your salvation was guaranteed by your commitment to Christ, your conversion. It was linked to the idea of the total depravity of man. Man was so depraved that he could not be made good. So instead of being made righteous, the righteousness of Christ was imputed to him when he committed his life to Christ. Imputed to him, not given to him, not put into him. It's almost like a legal fiction, isn't it? And the idea then was that, well, what do you do with the man after he's converted? In his biography of the Countess of Huntingdon, who was, of course, a Calvinist, Boyd Stanley Slinther emphasizes the dilemma of the Calvinist preachers of the day. What did they do with the converted? They couldn't be made holy. They couldn't grow in holiness. That was excluded by their theology. So they tended to preach conversion again. How many times does somebody need to be converted? The phrase that is very often used of the Calvinist viewpoint is once saved, always saved. And it's based on a simple text that God who saves has the power to keep. And that's the danger of taking a text out of context. The Bible, as I said last week, is not a collection of proof texts. It's a revelation of the divine grace, and it's working in the lives of men over a period of centuries and relevant to all the centuries since. Now, if you believe that man is totally depraved and his righteousness is only imputed, that opens the door to all sorts of difficulties. And the one that Wesley confronted most strongly was a heresy that is known as antinomianism. Have you heard the word? Those who have been in the in Edge Hill have, obviously. Antinomianism is the idea that once your soul has been saved, it doesn't matter what happens to your body. You can do what you like with it. The salvation was treated as a sort of insurance policy, that on the day you were converted, it was signed between you and Christ, and now you were sure that you were going to heaven. And you could do what you like. You could dip the fingers into the till in the shop where you worked. You could deceive people. You could malign people. You could do anything. It didn't matter. That was only the body. That was not the soul. And it reached the point, and this was the one where Wesley was most determined, where a number of men were saying that having been saved, they could now use any woman they liked, provided she agreed, because that was only the body, it wasn't the soul. And that is the logical conclusion of that particular form of doctrine. Again, I don't know of any Calvinist today who would hold it, but this is what Wesley was arguing against in the 18th century. In the 18th century, and saying that in order to preserve your salvation, you have to preserve your faith. And how do you do that? Well, there are things that we call the means of grace. Bible study, private prayer, meeting for devotion and study and fellowship, gathering with the people of God for worship, receiving the sacrament, supremely, in Wesley's view, receiving the sacrament. For that was taking something of the life of Christ into your life. And as long as you went on doing that, as long as you continued to meet with fellow Christians, to worship, to study, to praise, then you could retain your faith. But if you stopped, the grace of God diminished in your life and faded and needed to be restored if you were to be finally redeemed. And that seems to me to be a much more realistic approach to life. I have already in this series mentioned John Trembath. John Trembath, that Methodist preacher whom John Wesley left in charge of the work of Dublin when Wesley went back to England in 1747. Trembath, a Cornishman, a brilliant preacher. Everybody loved him. Everybody told him how wonderful he was. And he got careless. And he lost his faith, and he lost his mission, and he lost his ministry. And years later, John Wesley found him in Cornwall, old, impoverished, and unrecognizable, because he had failed to keep his faith. He had been diverted by a sense of self-importance and a sense of self-satisfaction. Now, I think that's why I rejoice in that last piece of John Wesley's four emphases, the necessity of continued faith for final salvation. And I think it's a tragedy that our Council on Faith and Order has published a book and republished it without any mention of that. I find that extraordinary. And I shall be writing to the council to tell them so.